Well, thanks for coming, everyone. I was thinking that it wouldn't be on because of this weather, but thank you for making the effort to come out on this sleet and snowy day. Now, I always think that once something's written and it's published, it's kind of dead. The letter, the letter's dead. It's kind of it's lost its life in a way. So, what I'm going to do today, I'm going to be speaking a bit about the importance of religion that I published about a year ago, but. Only the first section concerns that, because I think, thinking doesn't stay still, does it? It moves on. So I think this is going to reflect some moving on thinking from that book. So religion as action I'm going to be focusing on today. And the questions I'm going to be looking at are two interrelated questions. One is, what does a phenomenology of religion, a phenomenological theory of religion, look like when it faces two kinds of reductionism? One is a historical reductionism, the other is a cognitivist reductionism. Certainly in the study of religions, there's, as some of you probably may not be from a study of religions background, but there's a cognitivism is a big sort of new emergent field where you can explain religion in terms of brain function. And it's quite exciting and interesting in many ways. So this is going to look at how phenomenology can engage with that in a perhaps an interesting way. And so those two kinds of reduction, historical and cognitivist. So I'm going to address those two issues today, really. Unless there's only a few of us here, we could make it more sort of dialogical, if you like, so do interrupt or object. Now, the phenomenology of religion, the roots, is philosophically, it's rooted in Husserl, in Edmund Husserl, who dies in 1939, Jewish philosopher, who is regarded as the father of phenomenology. And the basic ideas behind it are that... before I say that, there was a question, how can we study religions, especially other religions, in an objective and kind of scientific way? The phenomenology of religion was an attempt to kind of address that problematic. And so, but its philosophical roots are in Husserl and in the idea of intentionality, which is that consciousness is always intentional, which means it's always got an object. So it's not like the common use of the word intentionality. I intend to go to the supermarket or something. But I think it's related to that. But it means that consciousness is always of something. You're always conscious of something. There's no consciousness without being conscious of, unless you're asleep. I mean, some religions, I suppose, Buddhism, some kinds of Hinduism, say that there's consciousness can be have itself as its own object. Well, that's a slightly odd claim in a way, but we can look at that perhaps later. So the consciousness always has an object, or what Husserl called the cogitatum, the object of consciousness, or the cogitationes, the flow of the objects of consciousness. And this he related to a method of knowing something, which he called noesis, the way you know something, and noema, the object of knowledge. The object of knowledge and the cogitatum are connected up together, and they think they're more or less the same. So the idea was that you... So that's the basic premise, that consciousness is always consciousness of something. And then, therefore, how can you inquire into the objects of consciousness? Phenomenology, he envisaged it, was an inquiry into the objects of consciousness, into the cogitationes, or the noema. So how do you do that? You do that through description. And you do that through suspending the question of the being behind appearances. So you bracket out the being behind appearances. So you don't ask questions about whether something really exists or not, because that's not of initial interest. What you ask questions about is its appearance, how it appears. So he gives the example in the Cartesian Meditations of a house. You go into a house, you don't know what the house is like, but you you get to know the house more and more the more you inhabit it. And so you intuit the essence of the house. Sorry, I'm leaping ahead of myself. There are two stages. Then what he called the... Sorry, I haven't written this down. I'm just ad-libbing now. The epoche, which is the bracketing. You bracket the question of being behind appearances. And that allows you to describe appearances equally without worrying about whether it's true or false. So the appearance of the table or the appearance of the gods or the blue rabbit on the table or whatever, you can describe those appearances without making judgments whether it's true or false. So you put that aside. And then the next stage in his process was the what he called the eidetic reduction, the reduction to essences or the eidos of something, or the intuition of the essence, which means through getting a full description of something, you can then intuit the essence of it, understand the essence of it. Like a house, you go into a house, you don't understand the fullness of the house, but the more you get to know it, the more you intuit the essence. And then that leads into the idea of typology, that you can create different types. You can have categories of description, different types of description that fall under the same category. And this influenced the phenomenology of religion, where you get different types of religion, like monistic religion, dualistic religion, theistic religion, the sacred tree, and so on. Different ritual, myth, all these are categories, all these are typologies that phenomenologists say you could develop from the Husserlian project. Now, this has come under a lot of critique in recent years, particularly from people like Tim Fitzgerald and others, Tomoko Masuzawa. And Fitzgerald wrote a book called The Ideology of Religious Studies, and Masuzawa wrote a book called The Invention of World Religions. I can't remember the precise title. That was about 3 years ago now, I think. Fitzgerald's book is about 2000. And then he's written another book more recently, arguing the same kind of thing. What is the argument? The argument is that religion is a category that's developed only in the West and is projected and imposed on other societies and other cultures, and is used has a political agenda behind it, i.e. the depoliticisation of other cultures. So, you know, India's mystical, India's got religion, therefore doesn't have political power, and is therefore and is in the service of colonialism, according to Fitzgerald. In fact, he even says that religious studies is in the service of American foreign policy in that last book. It's a slightly strange claim. And then you've got a post-colonial critique by Arvin Mandir and other and people like that, along the same lines. So the basic idea is that category of religion is a Western construction, and it develops from the private-public distinction, the public governance distinction versus... the private religion... Locke wanted religion to be in the private realm and governance in the public realm after 30 years of religious war. So we think of religion as something to do with privacy and your private life, and is depoliticised, and that's their critique, really. And that distinction is projected onto the colonised other, and thereby depoliticising the other. So that's... And they argue that phenomenology of religion doesn't recognise this process and doesn't recognise the constructive nature of concepts, and doesn't recognise the political nature of scholarship. Now, I want to have a look at this more closely, this idea of construction and projection, but I thought we'd look at something slightly older, 1920s, and... in my view, a sort of more intelligent version of this, which is Georg Lukács, a Hungarian Marxist philosopher, who has a critique of religion as reification, which is related, I think, to these contemporary critiques of religion. And he says, the eye sees its broken reflection in the world due to alienation. So we're alienated, which is a classical Marxist idea, from the world and from each other, because the subject of first person predicates, the I, projects into the world its own alienation from others and from itself even. Alienation for him, he calls it the elevation of interiority. which creates a self-world distinction. So there's this idea of the interiority, inwardness, is a sign of alienation. It's where the I is alienated from the world and from others. And that creates a self-world distinction. Dissociation would be an extreme form of that. I suppose schizophrenia would be in a very extreme form of that. And the need for meaning in face of fragmentation. So we have this fragmented world in which the I is shattered. So how do we create meaning? And he thought that the retreat into religion and indeed into metaphysics was the I's attempt to heal itself and to retreat from the fragmentation that it faces. Now, this kind of distorted perception of the world he called reification, which is making something into a thing, turning something into a thing as a feature of alienated social and political life. And relationships between people are reified, he says. And society, he thought, as a totality that we try to grasp as people, as individuals, but we cannot because it's beyond us to grasp the totality of society. So we become estranged from the social world. And this is a feature of alienation. So how do we overcome this? We have to realise that the I is, the interiority of the I is alienation and reification, and that the truth is that the working class is the true subject of history. So once we realise that, we'll be all right. Now, so reification is inscribed within material reality for him. Now, there are more recent versions of this. Habermas's theory of communicative action, which seeks to overcome distorted communication, which is that you can read as reification. And religion, on these terms, is reification, is making something solid of relationships which are not. Religion is reification and bolsters up injustice. It bolsters up hierarchical social institutions and reifies them as something real and unchangeable. So, you know, in the 1980s, the minor voting conservative would be an example of alienation and reification. Or Luchacz gives an example of a factory worker who works, 10 hours a day or more, and then goes to church at weekends to affirm the social body and the social place and her place in the scheme of things, and that's alienation and reification. Now, there are problems with it. I mean, much as it's attractive and neat and it's sophisticated, I mean, what I've given is a crude version of Luchacz, but most of this is written in his book, Consciousness and... No, Class... Oh, I can't remember what it's called. Class Consciousness... And something Class Consciousness. Sorry, I can't remember the precise title right now. But the problems with this view is that the proletariat can't be the subject because it cannot contain a singular will. Only persons can act and so be free of social structure in some sense. But there can be collective judgment, I suspect, as we'll see later on. And reification assumes that we can separate religion from society and culture. But often the religious is inseparably bound up with the social, so in Islam. I was talking to somebody about this, but they did say that Islam has a separate word for religion from than society.
They have separate words for faith and things like that. There's certainly other concepts.
Yeah, so... So politics and religion are separable in Islam, I think. So these characters that I was talking to, these Islamicists, I trust they should know what they're talking about. So reification assumes that we can separate religion from society, culture. But the problem is religion is often tied up with it. So... there is a true perception of society and culture, which is the Marxist view, according to Lukács, and you have to change your false consciousness, which is your reified consciousness, in which the I has a sort of interiority, with a true consciousness, which is consciousness of the working class as a true subject of history, and the healing of broken social relationships.
Could I just ask how he does separate the two?
Lukács.
Because in what you said, it seems like he actually considers religion like almost symptomatic of what's going on socially. It seems to fit into the Marxist.
Oh, it does.
Idea that it's playing a role in the society.
But there is society is real, if you like, and religion is illusory. I think that's his thing, and that there is a true perception of society, which is the historical process and realizing the historical role of the proletariat. Now, religion is a fantasy that you think is real, but it's not. That's the distinction he's making. So it's between truth and untruth, I guess, truth and falsity. The problem, and also interiority. He says the elevation of interiority is the root of reification. You can arguably separate interiority from alienation, and you need to understand the importance of religious meanings that drive human communities. And I don't think Lukács really does that. Well, he doesn't. He's got no sympathy at all for it. And what can we take? But what then can we take from this reification view? I'll return to that point about the need to understand the importance of religious meanings presently. But I think what we can take out of the bag from Lukács and just hang on to, put it on the shelf for a minute until later on, is his insistence on materialism. But we need to critique his view of religion as escape from the material world. I think he actually doesn't understand the nature of religion. But we'll take that out of the bag of Lukács and his insistence on materialism and hold on to that for a minute. Okay, that's the first kind of reductionism that phenomenology of religion faces. I've given the example of Lukács because he's an older version of perhaps the Fitzgerald kind of position. And indeed, Fitzgerald comes out of a Marxist position. So we have to engage with that historical kind of reductionism, and we have to see what's of value in it and what isn't. Second kind of reductionism that I want to look at, and perhaps bring these two ideas together later on, is that cognitivist reductionism. So particularly recently, there's a big, a lot of resources and interest is in the brain, and understanding religion in terms of the brain. So that the department at Aarhus in Denmark is more or less devoted to, apart from Bjarne, is devoted to brain studies and these brain scans and finding out what parts of the brain light up when you're reading the Bible, and the same part that lights up when you're reading... what's that book? I think you're reading Playboy, I was going to say. But no, when you're reading... I can't remember the name.
Harry Potter.
Yeah, Harry Potter or something.
Fisher
Shows are great. Yeah, the same parts light up. You know, it's interesting. Now, the brain, the amygdala part of the brain, responds appropriately to conducive properties of objects of perception. So Bowker writes that in his book, The Sacred Neuron. Now, we recoil from snakes, for example, because the perception bypasses what's called the neocortex. The neocortex is the front of the brain that deals with language and intelligent things, intelligence. But the amygdala is the part of the brain that deals with emotion. And in reptiles, apparently, it deals with smell, but it's about the size of an almond. Now, Darwin knew about this, and he tried to overcome. He thought that the reasoning, the neocortex, if you like, in the cognitivist jargon, could control the rest of it, but and it can't. So he put him, he went to London Zoo, put his face right in front of an adder's cage, if you're not a cage, a glass box where the adder was, and the adder went for him, of course. And he recoiled backwards. He said he jumped back about a yard without any control over his response. So thereby proving that the amygdala, bypasses the neocortex. The perception bypasses the neocortex.
Oh, this is a funding application.
Now that's interesting. It's not just the brain that's doing it. It's a correspondence between brain and objective outside reality. So the snake is constraining the behaviour of Darwin in these ways. So cognition is a response to certain conducive properties. So the conducive properties in art produces the language of satisfaction. I think this is a fairly controversial kind of claim that some of the cognitivists make, but I find that fairly convincing in a way. So there are conducive properties, objective conducive properties, that are independent of our brains, but nevertheless interact with our brains in certain ways. So you see, you know, a beautiful painting, and you go, ah, that's the language of satisfaction. Or conducive properties, or the cognitive has done quite a lot of work. Do you remember about 20 years ago, as Paul Ekman did all that work on facial recognition, and he said there are basically four emotions which are universal, according to his scheme. One is happiness, one is sadness, one is disgust, and the fourth one, I can't remember what the fourth one is, I'm afraid. But disgust is one, which are universal. So the conducive properties in objects which evoke these responses in human beings, universally, against the cultural reductionist claim. So, I mean, there's an example. There's a arguably the objective properties in this cave art evoke the language of satisfaction in our brains, in our mouths. But art can also disrupt this too. So Hermann Nietzsche's orgy theatre doesn't evoke the language of satisfaction, arguably, or perhaps it does. Now, religious forms, arguably, like ritual, prayer and contemplation, like art, can contain conducive properties that evoke the language of satisfaction. But above all, conducive properties are evoked in response to other people. And this leads into the idea of religions as communicative action. Religions are media, are communicative, against Luchak's understanding of religion as escape. So these practices, ritual, prayer, contemplation, which are often shared and collective, contain conducive properties that evoke certain, relate to our brains in a certain way and provoke certain kinds of responses, arguably. Particularly interaction with others. Now, religions are a communicative action.
I think one can claim that. And that this response is fundamental to religions.
Now, backing up that kind of idea, you've got what's called second-person neuroscience developing. Which is the idea of social cognition. And social cognition, these neuroscientists, particularly from University of Cologne, there's a paper that you should look at, which is not published yet. It's in the Journal of Brain Science or something. But it's on the web. It's a pre-publication thing. It's called Second Person Neuroscience by Kai Forgalai, his name will come up in a minute, and Gary Benty and some others. And they've been doing work on what they call second-person neuroscience, which is that the face-to-face affects the results of research, affects research outcomes. So it's no good studying cognition through in a lab, you have to. Well, you can do it like that, but the results are different when you're as a researcher are engaged with the people that you're inquiring into. It's hardly surprising in a way, actually.
Did
but
they
anyway.
Do like lab tests to work that out?
Yeah. They did lab tests, particularly with neonates. They came up with this new evidence. A neonate is a baby. So, anyway, the face-to-face affects research outcomes. You know, you wire babies up to EEG machines and they start crying, but if you pick them up, they stop crying. So. Anyway, because this is hardwired into our brain systems. And there are two systems that are particularly interesting in what's called the mirror neuron system, which is that our neurons mirror each other. My mirror, our neurons fire in response to each other. And also the mentalizing network system, which is another brain system, which I don't understand and don't claim to. But all this points to a rejection of dualism between behavior and mind. So this is what they're refuting. They're refuting the second person neuroscientists refute their own, critique their own practice that has been third person and has claimed a sort of scientific objectivity through distanciation, which they say it plays into an implicit mind-body distinction, which is not supported by empirical evidence. Now, the second-person approach argues for social knowing based on interaction and emotional engagement rather than observation as our primary way of knowing. So the face-to-face is the primary way of knowing. And they've done a lot of work on neonates' responses to faces. And the mirroring occurs in the neonates to the face that you present to them. In a way, you know, anyone knows that. Don't they? They know which parts of the brain fire up now. So this is Schildbach writes: when we are personally addressed by others, the perception of their mimic behaviour relies, in neurobiological terms, upon tight perception action coupling with affective and body-based processing, feeding into and promoting the preparation of motor responses as a way of picking up and responding to the possibilities of interaction. You've got to read that twice to understand it. When we are personally addressed by others, the perception of their mimic behaviour, so we imitate each other, in neurobiological terms, upon tight perception-action coupling, so perception and action are linked together, with affective and body-based processing, feeding into and promoting the preparation of motor responses as a way of picking up and responding to the possibilities of interaction. So in other words, we respond to situations with our bodies and minds, and we're engaged in situations, and this has neurological correlates. That's the title of the thing, the Behavioural and Brain Science, and it's coming up pretty soon, that paper. Now, so the idea is that neurobiology of human cognition frames all human social interactions and therefore frames all religious actions, because religions are social, are part of the social fabric. Therefore frames religions as communicative practices. And this is relevant to the study of religions, and it brings together the human and the hard sciences. But you can have a second-person neuroscience. One of the claims is that it's not reductionistic, that an old-fashioned cognitivism is reductionistic, because it says our behaviour is nothing but the brain firing in certain ways. But this rejects that cognitivist kind of reductionist model. So this is a new version. The old cognitivism says that, or linked in with biological determinism, that the purpose of life is the reproduction of the genes. So, it's William Johnson's, a chicken is an egg's way of making another egg. It's that kind of argument. But you could argue that that's to miss the point of the chicken, you know. So the questions arise, how does the face-to-face level develop into social cognitive capacities? And how does this relate to religion? How does it relate to phenomenology? So those are the questions I want to look at. So in sum then, these people, the neuroscientists, the second person neuroscientists, are interested with the face, what they call the face-to-face, and that's the fundamental space of human interaction. And that in the face-to-face, the brain changes in certain ways that you can map. Now, there are two implications, I think, for the study of religion. We need to understand religion in terms of historical time and in terms of the kinds of processes that Lukács was talking about. But we also need to understand religion in terms of the face-to-face and social cognition. And we can do that through looking at religions in terms of action or habitus as practices that you develop over many years, as ethical codes or laws, ritual, asceticism, prayer, diet, reasoning, and so on. So the practices of religions. So you could claim that religions are ways of controlling the face-to-face. They assume the face-to-face and they engage with the face-to-face, and therefore they engage with a deep sociality in an attempt to control it, and they control it through codes of law, ethics, and so on. So, if you say the face-to-face is the realm of the ethical, which you probably have to, then religions are an attempt to control that face-to-face in different ways. So religions are concerned with the face-to-face, and therefore with the mirror neuron system, and with the mentalizing system, which is the realm of the ethical. And religions are therefore concerned with action, speech, and world. And religion controls the face-to-face, so who you can and can't marry and this kind of thing. Now, a theoretical phenomenology can be combined with cognitivism of the kind I've described. Second-person neuroscience needs phenomenology. It's not enough by itself, and this is why neuroscientists are talking to the phenomenologists and so on. A first-person neuroscience recognises the observer is implicated in the... Sorry, second-person neuroscience recognises that the observer is implicated in study. I mean, we know this from Heisenberg, but we haven't really taken it seriously. We know this from Husserl and even Heidegger. I mean, Husserl wrote that book, the Critique of... that last book he wrote... On the sciences. What's the title? 1938. It's a very good, very interesting book. But he argues in that book, the last book he wrote, published, was that everything went wrong with Galileo. Galileo is mathematicizes everything, and you get an objectifying science developing from Galileo down to the present time, which he calls scientism, which is the illusion for Husserl that science is somehow objective, independent of observation and the observer. And he wanted a phenomenological science which recognises the situated nature of inquiry and the situated nature of the observer. The crisis in the European sciences, that's what it's called. And Heidegger also recognises this, and in his later work on The Event, and also in that early book, The Phenomenology of Religion, which the first half of it is all about history, and his students complain, what are you going on about history for? Well, he's recognising there that the religious practices come from the past, we inherit them from the past, in an age now which we no longer recognise their value or importance because we don't understand the world that they came from. Now, Heidegger says to understand that world, you have to understand history. And to understand history, you have to develop what he called the formal indication, which is the recognition of the humanity, the historical humanity, through my own humanity. There's a formal indication in my life of the life of others in historical time. Now, an old-fashioned 19th-century view of science is inadequate to understanding religion, arguably. But a second-person neuroscience shows us that the study of religion and social science broadly needs to be dialogical, in a sense, as is implicit in
Husserl and indeed Heidegger. So I missed out one, haven't I? No, but one here. The observer implication studies. So secondly, you can operate, I think study of religions needs to operate within a non-reductionist materialism. Now by that I mean that we have to recognise the material nature of the sign. Religions as communicative systems are very much concerned with signs. And signs are material in nature. There was a book by Voloshinov called A Marxist Philosophy of Language, which he spoke about the material nature of the sign. Language, for example. Words I'm speaking, there's material. But the problem is, and also material causation is terribly important, both historically. I mean, I know Hume critiqued the notion of causation. There's no rational justification of causation. But human experience seems to indicate that material causation is has a big effect on our lives. Well, thank heavens. I mean, if it didn't, we'd be chaotic, wouldn't it? But we have free judgment, that's the idea. Now, it's interesting, you talk to these neuroscientists about judgment, and they say we don't talk about judgment because there's no neurological correlates for judgment. Which is interesting. Now, the new view of the mind in the world is in some ways closer to pre-modern religious cosmologies, in which a person is embedded within a cosmos, in which you've got a hierarchy of angels and demons and all the rest of it, but you don't have a dualism of mind and body the way that develops with Descartes. With Descartes and later in the sciences, religion retreats from cosmology, and cosmology gets taken over by the hard science and dominated by the view of material causation. And the mechanistic world. Now, and so the mind retreats out of the mechanistic world as free mind, mechanistic world. Free mind is outside of the world and interacts with matter. Now that's the old model. That replaced the cosmological worldview of pre-modern Christianity, which also has parallels with pre-modern Asian religions. And now, of course, we're moving into a new paradigm. We don't believe dualism anymore. We don't believe the old cosmologies anymore either, but we don't believe dualism anymore. And in some ways, the new view of the mind, consciousness is in the world, consciousness emerges in the complexity of world. And that's closer to pre-modern religious cosmologies in some ways, so arguably allows us to understand those pre-modern religious cosmologies in a way that the older model couldn't, or was more prejudicial against. And the consequences of this are that religions are not escapes from the world, but ways or modes of entry into the world, and ways of modes of entry into history, because of the material nature of the sign and material causation that they operate within. Religions operate assuming the material nature of the sign and assuming the material nature of causation. So as opposed to Luchak's, they are not escapes from the world, but ways of entering history. Religions access modes of the brain concerned with deep sociality, and indeed have survived for millennia. So, Dawkins' God delusion, one suspects they won't be reading that in 500 years' time, but one suspects they'll still be reading Aquinas in 500 years' time, or the Bible in 500 years' time, but we don't know. Therefore, the study of religions needs to be dialogical, as is second-person neuroscience. Now, this leads me to the last section. If we're going to look at religion in terms of action, we might develop what we might call act theory. Now, this is about the subject-history relationship. Now, for Luchak's interiority is a sign of alienation through reification and the fetishization of society, which is from Marx, fetishization, turning something into a thing. But inwardness, arguably, in religions, is participatory and not individualistic, so it's arguably shared in some ways. And persons impact on history through action. So religions are concerned with the way persons impact on history and therefore with action. And there are two kinds of action in religion. There's the unrepeatable moral act and the non-identical repetition of the ritual act. So the ritual act is repeated every day, every year, but it's never quite the same, so it's a kind of non-identical repetition. But the moral act is unrepeatable, arguably, and in a sense all action is kind of unrepeatable. So I think, is it Bakhtin? So it talks about, it's like an action is like, you don't know the consequences of your actions. You can judge them to some extent, but you don't know, beyond a certain extent, you don't know the consequences of your acts. So like a grasshopper jumps in the air, it doesn't know where it's going to land. Ricoeur wrote an article on action, considered as a text, in which he compared action to a text which has authority. The author intends a certain meaning in the text, but the text itself goes beyond the author's intention. So our acts go beyond our intention. But you can look at acts in terms of intention, imagination and judgment. We make judgments, which then result in action, and those judgments are informed by not only our intentions, but also our imagination. We imagine a certain result, and that imagination is informed by our worldview. So I try to do a little diagram here, but I'm not very good at these 3D kind of things on PowerPoint. But it's actually not quite right. Oh dear, what's happening? So inwardness and world is not the world should be over on the right hand side. So on the left, you've got inwardness and you've got world. They're the two big things, and inwardness corresponds to intention and imagination, and world corresponds to event and chain of events. Now, you've got judgment. They see judgment in the middle. You've got judgment, which is informed by intention and imagination. Now, judgment leads to movement. I want a cup of tea. So that leads to getting up, going and putting the kettle on, and leads to movement in space. And the event is the event of kind of, you know, putting on the kettle, making the tea, I suppose that could be regarded as an event. But now events themselves sometimes cause chains of events which are outside of, beyond judgment, outside of intention or imagination. So you make a cup of coffee. Your wife comes and knocks it over and scalds her arm or something, and that leads to argument, which leads to a divorce or something. You know, there's a chain of events which is beyond beyond the intention of the behind the judgment. Now, in terms of history, Caesar crossing the Rubicon, the Ricoeur uses this as an example. There's a judgment Caesar makes to cross the Rubicon, the river Rubicon, which leads to movement and the event of the crossing. And that leads to a chain of events outside of his knowledge. And history is like that. But the way we enter history is through judgment and movement. And religions recognise this and attempt to control it. Now, those judgments are often constrained by are always constrained by worldviews. Worldview constrains our judgments and our movement, and indeed constrains the events themselves. And events constrain also, there's a feedback loop, if you like, to intention and judgment again. So we make judgments based on the feedback we get from our actions. For example, South Indian dance possession rites, Tayams, where the dancer gets dressed up as the goddess or the god, and becomes possessed by the god in these ritual occasions that happen once a year. So here we've got an action, an event. Here we've got an event, which is the result of an action, which is the result of judgment made by the group of people to perform the event, and the judgment is informed by the world view, i.e., that there's a
a cosmology in which you can become possessed by gods and goddesses. And it's informed by the intention, the collective intention of the caste, if you like, who performs these events. There's also the intention of the individual, the judgment of the individual actor who compete to dance in these rites, and it's very highly competitive, and it's very highly prestigious to be chosen. And then they make judgments, they act, but then there's consequences outside of their intention. So they parade around the compound, and then alcohol is offered to them, or palm wine, which you can see in the kalasha in the pot on the right-hand side, and blood is offered to them. So they decapitate a chicken, put the chicken's body in the water, so the blood flows into the water, and then the water is poured out in front of the deity as the offering. And that's what he's doing with his bowl there. So there's another one. You just chop the chicken, pour the bowl out in front of the goddess as the offering of blood. So there's an example of religion as action. Now, there's not much impact on history here, but it's a chain of events. It's an event that is constrained by judgment, is constrained by worldview. And the individual intention of the dancer is sometimes comes into play as well. So one dancer danced through a fire. The fire walking is part of this as well, but burned his foot so badly he was unable to dance again, so he became crippled as a result of that. So that's a consequence of his action beyond his intention. Now, act theory, the structure of judgment movement, that's a historical act. Now, on the subjectivity side, the subject is unique and universal, and Badiou writes about this universal singularity, which you get from St. Paul. And judgment movement event versus random event, there are random events, like earthquakes and stuff like that, but also these human events which involve judgment, movement, and event. Now, where does one event end and the next event begin? I mean, that's an interesting question. Is there such a thing as an event as a distinct entity? But I think perhaps it might be more meaningful to speak of event rather than action, because action is, in a sense, the whole thing. Involves judgment, movement, and its result, or event. And you can also have collective judgments. Like, it's a collective judgment as to who performs the teum rite. It's a collective judgment whether to go to war or not. And the effect, which you could perhaps, event and effect exceed the actor's intention. You could, I suppose, say event was effect. Now, conclusion then, the universal is assumed in comparative religion. If you're doing comparative religion, you have to assume some notion of the universal, and this is supported by contemporary science, arguably. But we have to have a rejection, I think, of the Hegelian or Marxist totalization of history. And also a rejection. Okay, so on the one hand, you have to reject that totalization of history, but on the other hand, you also have to reject the localization or relativism of events. A pure cultural relativism is, in my view, is now no longer tenable. There's a new universal understanding of human beings emerging. Phenomenology of religion is grounded in a phenomenology of religion grounded in non-reductionist materialism, which means acceptance of the material nature of the sign and complexity, but which is also dialogical, seeing its historical specificity as Heidegger does in his Phenomenology of Religion, I think is a way forward in terms of the study of religions. Now, the mind is within the world, and that is in some ways closer to archaic religions than the dualism that we're just coming out of. And the new science allows us to understand religious action and its impact on the world through accessing human sociality of the brain. So the new science gives us hard evidence for the deep sociality of religions.
And cognitive science makes religious communicative practices intelligible in a new way. And the new science has a non-deterministic view of matter, in contrast to the old science of the dualistic Cartesian mode. And this non-deterministic view of matter intersects with cultural understandings of the world as well. So religions, then, are systems that lay claim to the face-to-face encounter. And what religions describe as communal presence, neuroscience describes as social cognition. And religions are about social transformation through act. And this is foundational to our brain structure. So phenomenology needs to be coupled with social cognition that allows us to see the importance of religion as part of the very nature of human subjectivity in action.